Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. You've dialed up Techonomics, and I'm Jason Middleton. One interview we aired about 18 months ago or so was with a professor who was also a provocateur. Her name is Kathy O'Neill. She had just published her book, Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. It's a book about algorithms, basically. Weapons of Math Destruction went on to win or be shortlisted for several awards, but that's almost beside the point. Professor O'Neill was once a quant on Wall Street. She was a big data engineer. She was tasked with helping big corporations make even bigger profits. She's what another professor, Scott Galloway, refers to as a traitor of her class, sort of like a one percenter saying that rich people should be less rich. And we do have a show about that, too, but the link is in the show notes. We wanted to bring Professor O'Neill back on to check in on any potential progress when it comes to biases in algorithms being reduced.
He asked, like, how do you cross-examine an algorithm? You know, how do you put that algorithm on the witness stand and cross-examine them? And I was like, yes, that's the right question to be asking.
O'Neill and I also discuss her new company that she built to help corporations analyze their own algorithms to see if they have biases, like race or gender, in them, and if they are within legal compliance, something referred to as corporate hygiene. Spoiler alert, not one healthcare company has contacted her team yet. Okay, let's get to it.
Yeah, I'm Kathy O'Neill. I'm a data scientist, and I started a company called Orca, O'Neill Risk Consulting and Algorithmic Auditing.
Let's go macro first, and then we'll drill into a couple of things. Okay, so you wrote Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Now, you published that, I believe it was long-listed for a bunch of awards in late 2016. What kind of progress?
Yeah, it came out right before the election, to be honest.
Right.
Like, it came out in September.
That's right. And, we spoke, I think you and I spoke in October of 2016. Okay, it's been too long, but how much progress has been made, or how little progress has been made when it comes to these weapons of math destruction?
It's a great question. And the answer is both too little and quite a bit. So I'll start with the good news. The awareness has skyrocketed, and that's a really, really exciting thing to see. In the sense that, like, I think the average person is starting to sort of suspect that what's happening to them on Facebook isn't necessarily, you know, the cleanest, best information. And they're starting to think maybe facial recognition on every single camera that they walk by on the street is, you know, a little bit suspect. So on the one hand, I think it's sort of a growing awareness of the public and of, you know, policymakers. Like, I went to a congressional subcommittee hearing, a congressional hearing a couple weeks ago where my friends were speaking, including Joy Bolognini from MIT Media Lab, who's been doing a lot of work on facial recognition, how it's not nearly as accurate for black women as for white men. She was speaking to the congressmen and women, and it was like, on the one hand, like, incredibly satisfying to see this actually being taken seriously, algorithmic harm. You know, one of the best questions that came from, I think, Republican Congressman, Jim Jordan, maybe his name is.
Okay.
He asked, like, how do you cross-examine an algorithm? You know, how do you put that algorithm on the witness stand and cross-examine them? And I was like, yes, that's the right question to be asking. You know,
oh,
so
wow.
That's really, really exciting.
Usually Congress doesn't ask those kind of really sharp questions, I find. They're about usually years behind where they should be on prep for this.
Right, right. And on this particular subject of facial recognition, I think it's a bipartisan issue. It's a civil liberties issue. You know, mistakes are palpable because they can put the wrong person in prison. And so I feel like we are making real progress in certain ways. And then, having said that, I don't want to be overly optimistic, because many of the algorithms that I discussed in my book are what I call B2B algorithms, or business-to-business algorithms. Hiring algorithms are created by these data companies and then rented, essentially licensed by these large companies like a Lowe's or a Taco Bell or a calling center. So they license these hiring algorithms or their personality tests, and then they're used on people who are applying for jobs at these enormous companies. And, like, who checks to see whether they're working? Who
Right.
checks to see whether they're even legally compliant? And it's the answer is nobody in particular. They're not as obvious to the public
Right.
as facial recognition is. They don't go into the public record like a facial recognition software will do in a court case. So I'm just saying that there's a slew of algorithms
right.
that are not facing the kind of scrutiny that some of them are. And I'm really happy about the ones that are facing that scrutiny, but I'm really also worried that only they are going to be held to higher standards. And the other ones, which are really, really important because they decide who gets hired where, for example, in the case of hiring algorithms, they will not face that scrutiny and they will not be tested and they will not be improved.
I think if people want to know more about this and do their homework, I strongly suggest you get The Weapons of Mass Destruction and then get the new book, Surveillance Capitalism, and put those two together and you'll see what she's talking about, what Professor O'Neill's talking about when it comes to these hidden algorithms. And you mentioned bipartisan right there, too. The House Judiciary Committee did unveil a top-to-bottom review of unnamed tech companies as we go to record this. There is a little bit of movement, so I definitely take your point. In November, a year after Weapons of Mass Destruction came out, you wrote an op-ed piece called The Ivory Tower Cannot Keep Ignoring Tech. And in there, you kind of call me out as a media member as maybe being too credulous in my coverage, but I think you know that I like to dig a little deeper.
But
sure. Have you seen any... Okay, let's talk about the academic side of it, because you're talking about the societal side of it. Let's get to the academic side of it, and we can touch on the capitalism on another show. But what about the academics? Because I saw that you got a little bit pushback on that, and I want to ask you about that next. But progress first.
I'm going to be honest with you. I'm a little cynical about this particular topic. I've been seeing a lot of, and it's kind of a repeat myself from the op-ed, a lot of sort of data science institutes popping up all over the country.
Right.
Most of them are partnering with corporate partners like Microsoft or a Google or a Facebook, and they seem more like sort of mills to try to get their graduates jobs at those corporate companies and partners than they really do making any effort to scrutinize the fundamental, business models of the companies in that sector. So I'm not really holding my breath for pushback from those kinds of academic settings,
right.
the ones that are directly related to data science, called data science institutes. There might be a couple of exceptions, and I'd love to be wrong. I mean, this is part of my job as a provocateur is to provoke people to prove me wrong. So go for it.
Uh-huh.
Now, having said that, the pushback you mentioned was probably my bad because I maybe didn't edit my essay correctly. I never meant to say that people individually in different departments like sociology, anthropology, law, in other fields, science, technology studies, all those fields have spent many years thinking through these technology issues and the sort of unforeseen consequences and negative consequences of technology overly trusted and blindly used. The point of my article was to say we should actually have institutional power. In other words, the skeptics shouldn't just be isolated in their own fields doing great work. They should be given institutional power the way that these data science institutes are. And that I don't see happening yet.
But I take your point. If you
look at the scale of the amount of money that these companies like Amazon, Facebook, Google, the scale of the money they have and the kind of expertise they want to purchase from these academic institutions, it's completely clear that the academic institutions, who of course want their graduates to go on to have great jobs and great careers, it's completely clear where they're going to be heading. So it's not like the incentives are so lopsided. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That if we just go by the financial incentives alone, this is a lost war, a lost war. There is no pushback. The question is, can academia as a unit, as a sector of the economy, can it do more than just respond to financial incentives? And that is the challenge I'm putting forth. And I don't see it. I don't see the answer yet.
Yeah.
In a good way.
I'm with you. I'll have to leave that one there due to time constraints because I want to talk about your new initiative, your new effort with ORCA. Give us the acronym one more time, please, as a reminder, and then let's talk about what you've been doing with it.
Sure. O'Neill Risk Consulting and Algorithmic Auditing. And the idea is that last part, algorithmic auditing. The idea is that I want to help companies audit their algorithms. That is to say, like, maybe your algorithm isn't doing what you thought it was doing. Maybe you want to double check it's doing what you think it's doing. Maybe your data team has trouble communicating with your business team. That would not be a new problem. Like, I will help bridge that communication gap. Maybe you're worried that your algorithm is actually performing illegally. Maybe it's discriminating. Or maybe it's just an ethical issue and you want to make sure that it's doing the right thing and you can't really figure out how to ask that question.
To me, you're describing corporate hygiene in a lot of ways, which should be like a common business practice, but apparently it's really not, I guess.
Well, I guess the point is that these new tools, this big data stuff, was all the corporate companies and, for that matter, government agency, everyone just jumped headlong into it without really asking the question, is this black box
right.
that just delivers answers, is it answering the question we're asking? And is it answering it in a way that is aligned with our values? And they don't know how to ask that question. They don't know how to check that answer.
I just want to give the scale of this. Is there any way, any anecdote you can give for a layperson to understand the scale of what you are talking about?
We in the United States and many other countries have lost the privacy battle. We've just lost it. And we either lost it because we gave away our data, or we've lost it because even if we didn't give away our data, people like us gave away their data. And then in the situation where we need something, like we need a credit card or insurance, or we're trying to get a job, it's a power situation, power dynamic, where the people who are maybe going to give us what we want ask us enough of questions so that they can sort of pigeonhole us, characterize us enough to say, oh, people like you have given away all their data, so we know everything about you. So just by asking us 3 or 4 or maybe up to 20 questions about what kind of music we listen to or what kind of movies we watch, they can sort of figure out our political affiliations, our sexuality, et cetera. It's really scary, but that is the fact about big data. That is what big data does. It sort of repurposes what seems like innocuous data
right.
into whatever it wants to be. So it's kind of like the way I look at it is we should maybe stop thinking about privacy in per se, and we should focus on specific moments when the data about us is a sort of higher level of need for privacy. You could call it a sort of fundamental intense privacy moment. There's probably a better way of framing that. But I'm thinking along those lines of like when you're trying to get insurance, you're trying a good insurance plan, you're trying to get a credit card, you're trying to like buy a car with a loan, you're trying to get a mortgage, or you're trying to get a job. Anything that's a financial issue or a livelihood issue, for that matter, liberty, like, you know, how you're sentenced to prison or when you're paroled. There are certain moments when it's really unfair that the kind of weapon, the sort of the weaponizability of these algorithms, that they can sort of figure out anything they want to know about you. And so at those moments, I think we should really scrutinize how the big data algorithms are, what they're doing with our data and how they're using the data.
So every person creates thousands of points of data every day. It's tracked continually. What I would say is, and I have been telling people, especially here on the show, is that you can be concerned about privacy. That's totally legit. You need to be focused on predictive. So privacy and predictive analytics, and that's, I think that's what you're talking about. They take all this data and then they say, well, your insurance rate should be X, Y, or Z.
You know, you just nailed it. Like, let me just give you a for instance, because I think this really, really captures the issue.
Okay, cool.
Everybody knows that everybody has a cell phone. Everybody has apps on their cell phone. Everybody knows that when they agree to those terms and conditions that nobody reads, that their location is available to anyone who's willing to buy it from the app company.
Mm-hmm.
So your location data is just simply widely available. If you go to bodegas, if you go to the corner store, and then if you hang out outside every hour or two for a few minutes, you're tracked, and they can figure out that you smoke. And if they can figure out you smoke, they can also figure out what kind of eating habits you have.
Yeah.
Long story short, with completely like freely available data, these companies can infer your risk of lung cancer, your risk of diabetes. They can figure out how much you exercise. You don't even need to buy a Fitbit, even though Fitbits is another way of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, you can get a predictive health score. And this could happen not just to you, but to everyone in your family. And for that matter, if the people in your family are not behaving like in a healthy way, or they have a high risk of diabetes, then you are then endowed with higher risk of diabetes. Long story short, the old-fashioned kinds of data privacy bills like HIPAA that used to protect our medical data are no longer relevant. Everyone can figure out like using this data, these new data techniques, how sick we're going to be, how expensive our insurance is going to be. Now, on the one hand, this is sometimes framed as a really great thing, because after all, if our doctors know we are at risk of certain kinds of problems, the doctors can theoretically help us avoid those problems. But if they're just sold in the open market, then insurance companies can use that to just decide you're going to be very expensive in the future. Here's what your premium is going to be. And they can actually price people out of insurance in the first place because they're going to get sick in the future. That's the kind of thing we should be thinking about. And it's going to happen to everyone for any kind of reason.
Yeah.
Nobody's protected from that. And it's because of the world we live in. So the my feeling is that we need to sort of scrutinize the way, for example, insurance companies use data about us, that it shouldn't be a free for all.
It definitely should not. You mentioned smartphones there, of course, as being contact points for the data they collect. The health monitors, like my Apple Watch right now, that collects data. I'll add cars. Ford is completely changing its business model to basically be a data collection and delivery service. Just happens to be in a metal box.
Absolutely. And, of course, they frame it as like an opportunity for you to pay a little bit less car insurance by being a good driver. But the way you should really, most people should think about it is if you're not willing to submit to the surveillance, then you're going to pay more. And by the way, I should mention, since we did talk about my company Orca, the reason I opened the company was to help health insurance companies, car insurance companies, make sure that their algorithms were fair and reasonable and legally compliant. But guess what? None of them have called me up yet and signed up as clients, because to be honest, this is exactly what my point was earlier in our conversation. Mm-hmm. Congress has not figured out, right, and the regulators have not figured out what's really going on yet. And it's going to be a while before there's enough leverage on those companies to do the right thing, to the point where they're going to actually ask me to work on their algorithms with them.
Yeah, this has been government's role and have been lying flat on the ground with it. I always enjoy speaking with you, Kathy O'Neill. I really appreciate your time this week. And like I said, when you're in San Francisco, if you want to let me know, maybe I could buy you some lunch or a cup of coffee.
It was my pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much, Jason.
Thanks. That was Professor Kathy O'Neill. She's an algorithmic expert specializing in finding biases in corporate algos. Her book is Weapons of Math Destruction, MATH, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. The other book mentioned and encouraged is The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. And that's by Dr. Shoshana Zuboff. She's at Harvard University. Those two books put together should have you questioning all of your digital decisions. Links to all are in the show notes at KGORadio.com or at the bottom of the podcast. My thanks to expert and friend of the show, Kathy O'Neill, for her time, and to you, of course, for listening. For executive producer Lee Hammer, I'm the host and the writer, Jason Middleton. This has been Techonomics. Have great weeks, everybody.